Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. Thank you for tuning in, and I'm very excited to announce that tonight will be another special edition on electroshock, informed consent, and litigation strategies. And in a little bit, our guest, Deborah Schwarzkopf, will be joining us. Deborah is a shock survivor who successfully settled a psychiatric malpractice suit out of court, which I consider a huge win. And she will discuss her efforts, which can be found on the ECT Justice website at www.ectjustice.com. I would like to invite you all to go look at that website as you're listening, and if you have specific questions for Deborah, you'll be able to call in at area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. I am going to bring Deborah in now, I believe. My little wheel on my computer is spinning. But this is really exciting because we don't very often get an opportunity to talk about electroshock in a way that is open and honest and really reflects the long issues, long-standing, long-term issues that have existed about this practice, which is torture. Don White, who has been on before in the past, and Sue Wittenberg and others have consistently said that this is not treatment. This is torture, and this is a crime against humanity. And last week's episode on electroshock can be found, a crime against humanity, you can listen to in the archives, where also Loretta Wilson, Catherine Cassio, Brenda LaFrancois, and John Breeding joined in the discussion. And I hope that this will be the second of many follow-up shows on electroshock until this is banned and that people are given true and accurate information about what it is they're being subjected to. Deborah, I believe your line is open. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on and talk to people about what you're doing. I'd like to ask you if you feel comfortable telling people a little bit about who you are and what you do. But first, I'd like to just read to you something from a draft that's being prepared by Loretta Wilson and John Breeding and others, that is looked at temporarily, currently called ECT pamphlet entering the gray zone. And so just for anybody who doesn't know what electroshock is, the procedure is described in this draft as electroshock involves the production of a grand mal seizure similar to an epileptic seizure by passing from 70 to 600 volts of electric current through the brain for 0.5 to 4 seconds. Before application, ECT subjects are typically given anesthetic, tranquilizing, and muscle paralyzing drugs to reduce fear, pain, and the risk from violent muscle spasms or fractured bones, particularly of the spine, a common occurrence in the earlier history of ECT before the introduction of muscle paralyzers. The ECT convulsion usually lasts from 30 to 60 seconds and may produce life-threatening complications such as apnea and cardiac arrest. The convulsion is followed by a period of unconsciousness of several minutes duration. Electroshock is usually administered in hospitals because they are equipped to handle emergency situations which often develop during an ECT session. Administration of ECT also varies enormously in the number of treatments, from one to literally hundreds over time. A typical course of treatment involves 6 to 12 sessions. Multiple monitored ECT is one variation which consists of three treatments in one session spaced about 5 minutes apart with three sessions in 1 week, thus 9 treatments in 1 week. That's nine times that somebody is having anesthesia, nine times with the muscle-paralyzing drugs, nine times with all of the other pain-reducing drugs and tranquilizers and the anesthesia, which inherently has a risk of death to it. Two important, the draft brochure goes on to say, two important pieces of information to know are that, one, the natural electrical activity of the brain is measured in millivolts or thousandths of a volt. Thus, the power of ECT is literally hundreds of thousands of times greater than natural brain electrical activity. Two, the average ECT procedure involves a level of electricity that can range from the minimum level of requirement to induce a convulsion up to 40 times greater than that. The official APA ranges from 1.5 to 3 times greater than that required to induce a convulsion. So this is a disturbing procedure that we really need to call attention to. So, Deborah, if you would talk a little bit about who you are and why you do what you do, and then maybe if we can slowly afterwards walk right through the website, ectjustice.com.
Sure. I'm 53. I'm a survivor of ECT, as many are that are listening. And I've had probably 60 or more ECT treatments. Initially, ECT was started on me because I had a reaction to an SSRI drug. I had a manic reaction, and at that point was labeled bipolar mixed rapid cycling. And the reaction I had to SSRIs, I ended up taking a loaded gun to my psychiatrist's office and ended up under the care of a psychiatrist, another psychiatrist, who was doing research using multiples in ECT. And instead of withdrawing me from the SSRI, started adding a bunch of drugs and started doing the multiples on me, which was three sessions in one setting. I had probably 30 of those over a three-year period. My psychiatrist ended up moving. I came under the care of Dr. James Ruther in Vancouver, Washington, who started in the first year heavily medicating me with benzodiazepines in addition to all the other medications I was on. In that first year, I was up to 16 milligrams, with the high dose end of Ativan being at 6 milligrams. And I feel badly that I didn't recognize at the time what was going on. I'm a registered nurse. I worked in emergency nursing for a good 20 years. And it was insidious. The onset, the changing of drugs, the ECT, it's like I lost control of my life. And so as the years went on, the dosages of the benzos kept escalating until under his care of 7 years, the benzos were up to 25 milligrams a day of Ativan. And in addition to that, he added 40 milligrams of Ambien a day, which most of you know is usually 10 milligrams at night, in addition to other benzos and other hypnotics. And so finally, during this process, I was under the care of Kaiser Permanente. He was an outside provider for them. And as I started having a lot of the paradoxical reactions to the benzos, meaning I was unable to sleep. I started having displaying manic behaviors. I was lucky to get 1 hour sleep a night if I was lucky. There were times I would go a week without sleeping. I was having a lot of amnesia related to the benzodiazepines, which is a normal side effect, especially in dosages greater than 6 milligrams. And I would frequently forget what I had taken. And so there were many overdoses. There were greater than 25 overdoses, most of them accidental. I'm sure there were a couple that were suicidal because benzos can increase suicidality. Most of them were accidental. I would forget what I had taken. And, in fact, in 1 month alone, I had 6 overdoses with 3 ICU admits. Still they were prescribing. The doctors knew what was going on. In fact, Kaiser records reflected that the main doctor who was doing my ECT at Kaiser said that many physicians feel that the underlying problem with Deborah is it's a paradoxical effect to benzos. And as well known, she's been on high dose long, many years of benzodiazepines. And I kept asking for detox, and it was never given to me. And I would refuse benzodiazepines when I was in the hospital in an effort to try and get myself off. And they never reflected in the notes that that the risk of having acute withdrawal, such as seizures, they never covered me for that either. And so, in effect, my sleep, of course, they were giving me IV morphine, trying to get me to sleep. So it was a mess. And so what finally happened was in 2011, in June, I had a hospitalization. I was discharged, once again given another prescription for 360 Ativan to go out with. And, in fact, Dr. Ruther at one point with the Ambien called his pharmacist that was in-house and asked if Kaiser would object to him calling in 40 milligrams of Ativan a day. And they said, in fact, that they would probably question that, but Kaiser went ahead and filled it. So I had all these meds on board. I wasn't sleeping, so they felt the best thing to do for me or to me was ECT. So I ended up with 30 bilateral ECT treatments. And
how many?
30.
30.
30 from Kaiser. So a total of 60. So anyway, in June after my last admission, I told the prescriber, Dr. Ruther, that I wanted to get off benzos, that I was going to get off them. And I asked for the drugs. I pulled the protocol for benzo withdrawal and asked for the drugs that I would need to remove myself. He knew what I wanted to do, and even when I told him I wanted to come off the drugs, he said, don't go below 12 milligrams. Well, in August of 2011, after another night of not sleeping, I was sitting at my dining room table, and the full reality came to me that if I didn't get off these drugs, I was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
So that morning, I packed my suitcase, put the drugs in there that I would need to detox, and flew to my sister's house two states away and detoxed myself over 2 months off of all psychiatric drugs. The longest I could stay out of the hospital when on all these meds was 15 days. For some reason, I'd be in the ER or I'd be in a hospital setting every 15 days. I was that unstable. So before I left, I started pulling some of my medical records, and I was astounded to look at the drugs listed. And I was in 8 different hospitals over the period of 7 years with Kaiser, and I had some problems pulling records from Kaiser Permanente, but took enough records with me to my sister's house that I could start reviewing them. And was just amazed at the care that I was receiving and that people weren't stepping in to save my life because I was desperately ill with all the drugs and the ECT. And so anyway,
they
so what happened
next? They have the audacity to call it treatment. I know.
I knew I wanted to sue somebody. I was that mad. And I started my website about the same time, too, because I needed a constructive outlet because I was ready to implode. I was that mad with and sad with what had transpired, how not one nurse stood up and said, you know, why is this patient was just in here this morning? Why is he back here tonight with another OD? You know, nobody stepped up and said, you know, as a nurse, I certainly would have. I would have questioned why this patient was repeatedly returning and on all these drugs. But
how
nobody
frustrating.
Did anything. Pardon?
Oh, how frustrating that must be for you to be in that position of knowing what people are supposed to be doing from a skilled professional point of view. And
not doing
seeing,
their jobs.
And standing by. How criminal. Just criminal.
And I've written some of the physicians at other facilities saying you must have known. And I sent records to them reflecting, actually showing them prescriptions for that amount of medication being prescribed to me. I never heard back from any of these physicians, of course. But anyway, when I was at my sister's house, I started reviewing records. And I started trying to find an attorney. And the shape that I was in, of course, was I was just withdrawing after 2 months of being on all those drugs for at least 7 years. And so writing these letters, my sister was trying to get me to type them. My writing was illegible. I was trying to talk to legal assistants on phones, and I couldn't keep my story straight, and I was still rather out of it. And so I probably would have had a better opportunity of finding a lawyer if I'd waited just a little bit longer. But I proceeded to send out all kinds of records to all these attorneys, couldn't find one. Came back to Oregon and went to Kaiser for all of my records. They wouldn't release, or they would release them just a little bit at a time, or, you know, records that I didn't ask for, they would give me. And so they were stalling. And I think they knew that I was looking for litigation. And so I ended up having to hire an attorney for $5,000 to get my records.
And under HIPAA, are you you're in the state, in the United States, right?
Yes.
So under HIPAA, what a violation just of HIPAA, because you're supposed to be able
exactly.
to get your records under
right.
the Health Insurance Portability Privacy Accountability Act, whatever it is.
Right.
Go ahead.
Okay, so what I ended up doing was filing a formal complaint with the Office of Civil Rights, which every state has, and they opened a formal investigation, not with just Kaiser, but with two other facilities as well who were hesitant to turn over records. Finally, two were found guilty of obstruction of records. Kaiser at the last minute did turn their records over. So that's what I had to resort to. I kept trying to find attorneys. Finally found one but I couldn't figure out why I couldn't get an attorney. I mean, everything was concrete, black and white, it was in writing. I was a reliable historian. I just couldn't figure out why I couldn't find somebody. And every time I would talk to a legal person, they would say, you know, I'd bring up UCT, and they'd say, oh, they still do that? I mean, you could hear the change in their tone of voice when they realized they were dealing with a psychiatric patient, number one, and then one that had actually had UCT. And so what I finally ended up doing
discrimination.
Was I found two pharmacists that reviewed my records and the pharmacy records and wrote letters, and that's how I got the validation behind me. One actually used to sit on the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. He wrote me a letter. And so then I submitted that to an attorney, and finally I got somebody to take my case.
Wow, that's amazing. And, you know, it's been reported to me in the research data that I did that the pharmacist had told someone that they were on too many drugs and that it wasn't right. And so maybe there's an untapped ally in the pharmacist that
exactly.
I never thought of
they
before.
They couldn't believe it when they saw it. You know, I mean, they wouldn't have filled these drugs. I mean, I didn't have a pharmacist that, you know, not a pharmacist said to me, you know, you shouldn't be taking this much, or, you know, nobody stood up and said, you know, this is lethal, you know, because virtually at 25 milligrams, you're overdosing every day.
And any one of them are lethal, right? The side effect of any one of them by themselves is just death. And so when you're then given an inappropriate dosage and scheduling for taking it and having every experience that you were having from the start probably invalidated and just knocked off as some, you know, quote-unquote mental illness that has no proof of existing, right? And
right.
so...
In the middle of all this, under the care of Dr. Ruther, I ended up surrendering my nursing license. I was unable to work and work safely, of course. And and because of UCT, I have some neurocognitive impairment with memory issues, and I can't get my nursing license back now. So that was a loss, and meant everything to me. So now I want to help others with litigation. I've been through it. I actually had a case settle out of court about 10 years ago with a breach in confidentiality over psychiatric records that were released. So that was settled out of court as well. So I really want to see more litigation go on around the issue of consent, because I think that could be the way in to some of these lawsuits. I just recently posted a page on the website on securing medical records, how to go about it and what to ask for to present to attorneys. And am currently working with a lady in Utah who was psychotic, she states, at the time of consent when she signed it. And she's sending medical records to review and possible trying to find an attorney to represent her in her ECT struggle.
Well, this is really fascinating, and I want to thank you for sharing all of it. At this point, sure. There are a couple of people who have been waiting on. I just want to bring them on, mm-hmm. and then I'd like to, if they have questions, but then I'd like to really take a really good hard look at the ectjustice.com website and ask you to go through and explain page by page of what things are,
sure.
if that would be okay.
Okay.
So area code 810, your line is open.
I'm here. Lauren, this is Loretta.
Hi, Loretta. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic.
Thank you so much for calling in. And I don't know if you were on when I was reading from the draft that you've been putting together with John Breeding and others, and I think it's just phenomenal, just phenomenal.
Thank you. I've thought about this since I began my search for the truth about my own experience, and I am just totally delighted that everybody is chipping in with their ideas, and Dr. Jay is being so kind and offering his expertise, and it's very exciting to think that these pamphlets could be done and actually distributed across the United States.
Yeah, and the world, right? Because
yes.
with the internet, here we go. I mean, just you know, get it out there. And I think that it's brilliant, and the idea of entering the gray zone as a title for it,
mm-hmm.
and how this is not a black and white issue immediately comes. I mean, on top of gray matter, of course, but that this is not a clear cut issue, with the exception of the fact that this does damage, and that this is torture. And that they don't have the evidence that they're putting forth about it. And, you know, I just for listeners to know, I had the pleasure of meeting Loretta at the ECT. Well, that wasn't a pleasure. At the FDA, the FDA's meeting. Meeting Loretta was a pleasure, unfortunately, under the FDA's 2011, January 27th and 28th, 2011, hearings on the panel of the neurological medical devices that was looking to get feedback and on whether or not the electroshock device should remain a Class 3 device as something that was grandfathered in to the safety and efficacy issues with no safety and efficacy testing, and lower it to a Class 2 device, which would render it as safe as a pair of eyeglasses or a wheelchair with no testing done on it and a complete denial of all of the evidence that we have of the damage it causes. Would that be a fair summary, Loretta?
I think it is. Even though you said, well, not really a pleasure, but it was a delight to meet you. The adverse circumstances, even that did not...
Yes.
Did not stop us, and
no.
I'm just so thankful that we did it, even in this horrible snowstorm that they had out there.
Yeah, it was really bad. It was really something. But it was incredible meeting you. And if I can say, one of the things that really I felt that you said that is so important for everybody to know is this issue that. Deborah and others who have called in and talked about memory loss and cognitive and neurocognitive impairment because of the electroshock, and your experience of having to deal with this reality because of the electroshock. Would you mind just telling people a little bit about what that was like for you and why you're doing all the work that you're doing?
I've been working on this because actually when I gave my speech to the panel, I identified the memories that were destroyed as being castrated. That was the strongest term that I could find in the English language to speak of how it felt to have those memories gone. and not be able to communicate a lot of things with my children and my family members. And I felt something had to be done. There's got to be something to stop this, because even like Deborah said, they never identified any of my problems with the medications. It was always, I was getting worse. I was mentally ill. But the medications drove me. I remember the walking off my weight. I went way down to skin and bones because the drugs drove me. I overdosed. I was not intent to die. It was the intent to escape what was happening inside of me. And I believe this is happening more than what we're hearing about, because
Absolutely.
Of the lack of a reporting system. You know,
right,
because
there's no mandate or standardized reporting rate that's required. So we don't really know. We have a glimpse, but we have no idea.
FDA doesn't make it easy to report either. I have gone on and tried to make these reports, and the limits and getting into the right spot, and it just hasn't been easy. I even made my phone calls, but still, it's not easy to report. I think it's a deter. They do it deliberately to deter people from making the reports. They really don't want to hear us. They don't want to acknowledge us. They only want to acknowledge the manufacturers, what they're saying about it. That's why I'm happy to see in the executive summary so many things that the manufacturers actually said, even to the point of death, that this machine has caused. And I think sticking with this reporting, this is the FDA reports, not mine. And this is what they gathered from the manufacturers. So, yes, we need the word out there. When I look at the booklet in front of me that a hospital handed to potential recipients, they're telling them that it's a myth, that it can cause permanent memory loss. Come on. That it's a myth.
And that they
that
didn't see
brain
that.
Damage.
And that I remember one of the, I think it was a neurologist or an ophthalmologist, I'm not sure which, who had said in their response period, how could you not see 30% or more of your memory loss being significant? Like pieces of people's lives, their education, their loved ones, that they have, how could you not see that as something that is considered a major risk? And the psychiatrists and the device makers continually poised this as something that was small. Even 0.1% of your memory being intentionally wiped out, that's a devastation not being able to have, and it's not like they can target things, although they're trying with this DARPA initiative that they're doing on veterans for post-traumatic stress and other psychiatric assignments, where they're going to be implanting electrical devices into veterans' brains to try to reroute the chemical impulses or the electrical impulses of the brain, and it's very scary. And so I, Loretta, if you'd stay on the line and join in conversation as comes up, I want to bring in one other caller who's been online waiting, and then get to the ectjustice.com website. And so if you're looking at it and you have questions for Deborah or want to have a comment or something that you'd like to share, please call in. Line 202, your line is open.
Yeah, this is Yvonne. Since you were talking about the reporting, I have looked, and they do have a form for you to fill out for devices and medication.
Right. It's just that they make it difficult to do, and they're not responsive to it, I think, is the issue. Even though they have it, they're not responsive. And the panel vote, the only people on the panel who voted to bring it to a class two, Loretta, correct me if I'm wrong here, are either the psychiatrists or the device makers. Everybody else voted to keep it out of class three and as an mm-hmm. experimental mm-hmm. device. That's, is that right?
Yeah.
And so the industry backup and the government collusion with the industry is just frightening, and every citizen should be aware that this is what the Food and Drug Administration as a practice is doing, and that this is a big problem.
Well, you know, at one time, I was on a patient council for FDA and other people from with not just psychiatric, because most of the people with cancer and had other illnesses, and they clearly told us that FDA is not saying if whether it's a drug or device, they're not guaranteeing the safety of it. They say that it does what the manufacturer claims that it would do. That's the only thing. I mean, people have to really do their own research, because they don't actually say anything is safe.
That's absolutely right. And Deborah, I'm just wondering if we can start on the home page and kind of move through. And if you would give just an overview on each of them, and then I want to spend a little bit of time on the both the informed consent page and the securing records page.
Okay.
If that would be okay. But if you could walk us through and just give highlights from each of the pages starting on the home page.
Sure. I'm pulling it up now because I don't
okay.
have it right now. Hold on.
It's
a nice looking page.
It is. It's great. And so the Simple Truth About ECT by Peter R. Bragan, MD,
right.
No One Should Be Given Shock Treatment would be at the top. So would you be able to just talk a little bit about what's there and why it's there kind of guide us through what you've got out there?
Sure. The home page was basically just trying to elicit people to fill out the questionnaire, to find out commonalities, to suggest that if you've had ECT, to possibly get some an EEG done, some neurocognitive testing. I'm trying to collect enough information from survivors to look at the long-term effects of ECT, what people live with at following, and I'm trying to get information if people had felt that they were given enough information around informed consent. So I'm just trying to figure out things that people can document to prove that there is memory loss, such as having neurocognitive testing done and after effects, such as, you know, continued seizures that EEG might pick up. Then you already talked about Peter Bragan's page on Simple Truth About ECT. There's a page that John Breeding wrote on ECT in children. The questionnaire, of course, that I'm trying to get people to fill out.
Right. Can we just walk through the questionnaire page?
Sure. Sure.
Just to let people know what it is. And so the website address for that, if you're listening in, is ectjustice.com/ectquestions.php. If you're a survivor of electroshock and want to add to this database that Deborah is putting together, if you could just walk us through how this questionnaire would go.
Sure. It's just the basics, the name, age, number of ECT treatments that you've had, if you can remember, what types of treatment you received, the name of the physician that performed the ECT and the facility that it was performed at. Were you given enough information for informed consent? If not, what do you feel was missing from the informed consent? Did you suffer any permanent memory problems as a result? If you answered yes to the previous question, what problems resulted from ECT? Have you had neurocognitive testing done? If you answered yes, when and by whom? Do you have permission to use? Do we have, of course, trying to find out if we have permission to use the information and if we can contact them. And there's several more questions that will be added this coming week around getting more information from patients.
What's the website address?
It's ectjustice.com. And we've had about 105 people apply to this site already as far as answering the questionnaire. But the more people that we can get on there, the better. I'm not sure what I can do with the information at this point, but I just want to collect it for now. And later on down the road, if we get enough people, then I would like to approach a law firm and just to see what potentially could be done.
Well, I feel like 105 responses is a lot, but not really. I mean, if you had everybody who did it and everybody who was listening, I'm curious, Deborah, of the responses that you've gotten, what have people been saying?
The majority of people, I would say probably 98%, feel they weren't given adequate consent, that they were not in a position to give adequate consent, and that they were left with memory and cognitive issues that were not addressed in consent. And long-term memory and cognitive impairment. A lot of people report that even the creative side of them, such as artists and people that I know personally, I took many years of piano. After all my ECT, I forgot how to play the piano. Had to start over again. So the creative side of the personality is disrupted as well. That's what a lot of people report. I think it affects many aspects of your personality. So,
right. I think this kind of information is so important to come together. And I did when the FDA had their panel meeting in 2011 through the OPAL project. We collected over 80 comments of people who were survivors of shock, and I put together a summary of that and presented it to the FDA. Maybe I can pass that information on to you and you can use those kinds of things. Because the question, all we asked was, do you have any comments for the FDA? So, but the issues remained the same without even asking all of these specific questions. And so I think it's really quite interesting as to how it's coming together. And the informed consent, when people say, as people in the States, we certainly aren't really encouraged to ensure that we have informed consent for whatever it is we're doing. Yvonne often talks about the little, getting the manufacturer's insert instead of the little 2x4 piece of paper that they give you. We generally, sign things without reading them and so on and so forth. And so
I know as a nurse that we could not get consent from a patient if we'd medicated them for pain. I mean, something like one drug, like Demerol, we couldn't get consent because they were impaired. And a lot of patients, even myself, on multiple medications that would impair people from being able to consent.
Well, I didn't know that. If you read all that, you won't want to take it anyway. You won't want whatever they're going to do. Whether it's ECT or it's drugs, if you read all of that, you wouldn't want to do it.
Right.
And that's the point of why they don't give you that information.
Well, that's definitely
what's interesting about Kaiser. About 2.5 years ago, if you looked at the Kaiser website, it's a big HMO. If people don't know who Kaiser is, they didn't even acknowledge that they did ECT on their website. And about a year and a half ago, they started acknowledging it, but they didn't acknowledge the long-term risks, such as short-term and long-term memory impairment. They do now acknowledge that on their site, that that's a possibility. I'm trying to get my hands on a recent consent. I have a friend that works for Kaiser that's going to try and pull a consent for me to see if they actually mention that in their consent, because it wasn't in my consent, the long-term memory and short-term memory problems.
Well,
I had no information at all for the consents that I signed. It was a standard surgical form, and they told me, just sign here so we can bill your insurance company.
Right.
Everything was filled out.
Unbelievable.
Except my signature.
Unbelievable. And so, Deborah, on the ectjustice.com/consent.php page, on the informed consent page there, as much as people are encouraged to give informed consent in just any general medical practice, there's also the issue that they're not actually giving any information to give informed consent to. And so if you're not given information, you can't really be given informed consent, right? And so I think that the information that you have here about your rights in informed consent and the standards for them, would you be willing to talk about each of the standards just a little bit that you've got on your page?
Sure. I've got to get to that page. I'm sorry.
Okay. And so anybody who's listening, it's ectjustice.com, and it's the informed consent tab.
Okay, so what do you want to know, Lauren?
Of the three standards, if you could just talk a little bit about the standards and how much information should be given.
Number one, it should communicate in the nature of the diagnosis, communicating the purpose of the proposed treatment, informing the patient of alternative treatments so he can make an informed and educated choice. So those are the three ones for, and it has to be, consent to be valid, they have to be competent to make a decision, has received sufficient information to make decisions, which we've already agreed that that's not provided, and not acting under duress. So those are the three.
So let me ask you this about this communicating the nature of the diagnosis. Wouldn't that have to include that there's no biological evidence for what it is somebody is experiencing, that there is no known etiology of this, that there is no known, there is no proof that what is being called, quote-unquote, depression or some kind of biological, quote-unquote, mental illness doesn't really exist? And so if in communicating the nature of the diagnosis, if somebody isn't told about, like, instead maybe a trauma model or, you know, alternative healing models of what, or a spiritual experience of what people are experiencing, then the very first standard of informed consent isn't met?
I don't think you would ever find that on consent. I don't know. I don't think they would ever put that. I think they just do the very basics, you know, what your diagnosis is and what your alternatives are. And
right, but it says communicating the nature of the diagnosis, so wouldn't they have to explain that they don't know what the nature of the diagnosis is and that there's no actual evidence for the diagnosis?
I don't know.
Maybe not that what's being done, but what should be done. Do you know what I mean? In terms of if you're really giving consent to some kind of procedure like electroshock, shouldn't you know that they don't actually know that there's some kind of biological existence to your problem?
Well, you should know that. I agree. You should know that. But I don't think that they would ever say that.
No, but this is Yvonne, but the standard mantra or public image they give to ECT is that this is the public image, that this is what is given in the last resort. This is what they say, that this is for those people who they failed so many other methods or whatever else. And I hear what you're saying, and I understand. I want you to go through those things too, because I want to know what kind of alternates, in other words, they would have to say to a person, look, we can do this ECT, and as a result of it, you know, you may lose your memory, you may have convulsions, your memories might not come back, the whole slew of things. But also, we think that instead of doing the ECT, that you might do X, Y, and Z, and that you have an option of other things to choose from. I think that's barely what you can see. I don't think that we'll ever see them say anything about it not being an illness, because that would be admitting that it's torture.
Well, it is torture, and I feel like if we're doing legal kind of efforts, that one of the things maybe they could be held accountable on is that they're not meeting the basic standards by not communicating the nature of the diagnosis, which is fraud. You know,
and
you know what I mean?
It's also a myth, really, that ECT is used as a last resort, because
that's
very controversial. Quite often, they use it the first. That's the first treatment of choice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, people I've talked to is not always a last resort. You know, it's sometimes the first line that they've tried. You know, they may have tried drugs. You know, a couple of drugs, but after that, they've moved them right to ECT.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
exactly.
And so last resort is quite subjective, right?
Yeah.
like everything else dealing with the nature of informed consent for this. And so, you know, the idea of, you know, below you have that how much information should I be given about, you know, quote unquote treatment, and you know, this is a crime against humanity. This isn't a treatment. That it includes what it is, how it will achieve, how long will it be effective, what are any likely side effects, what will happen if it's not given, and what are the alternatives. And so people aren't being given any of this information.
I remember consent, well, just one episode of consenting. They were in and out in under 5 minutes. I wasn't given any reading material that I recall. I didn't watch a video. Maybe this one instance, they just figured I'd had it so many other times before that I kind of knew the routine. But, you know, they were in and out in less than 5 minutes, and nothing about, you know, long-term memory. They would say things that were, you may have some innocuous memory loss, such as around addresses and phone numbers, but, you know, or around immediate treatment times. But nothing long-term, and people don't understand that when you talk about memory loss, it's not just a little sketchy. It's like frank amnesia. I mean, like, it never happened. I mean, I went to a friend's graduation the other night. Her son was graduating, and I became quite distraught because I couldn't remember my son's graduation. I couldn't remember.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't remember if I had bought him a suit, what he looked like when he walked across the stage, if I had given him a party afterwards. Totally wiped out of my memory.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing. People are suffering this way, trying to recall their lives.
It really is. This is just such a crime against humanity, and it's brain damage. The goal is to create brain damage, and brain damage is created every single time somebody is electroshocked. And that the number one medical effect of ECT is death. The second is brain damage. The third is memory loss. Fourth, cardiovascular complications. Fifth, extra risks for the elderly. And sixth, seizures and epilepsy. And taking away people's lives and destroying people's personalities and removing their creative ability. I mean, this is just, these are such crimes, and people need to be informed about this prior to them undergoing it, especially when you have organizations like the National Alliance on Mental Illness promoting electroshock for women who are pregnant who have been assigned as bipolar. And so this is a monstrously important idea for us to get our heads around. And I know from doing research, one of the things that is most important about informed consent is that it is not a one-time event. It is an ongoing process, and that people can withdraw consent at any given point in time. And I think that this is where we come in extra dangerous territory, because electroshock can be court-ordered on people. And then there is no informed consent. It's outright over objection. And as a society, we need to worry about this, because it can be anyone. All you need to be is in one of these electroshock mills, as Don White calls them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the end of it. You know, on here, I think you have, it's really interesting that you say you have the right to a second opinion by a psychiatrist not associated with the ECT program at the treating facility. And I'm a little, how does that work if you're in?
Well, that's a little ambiguous, because if you're dealing with a psychiatrist that is actually working in the facility where ECT is such a big money maker, I don't know if anybody, I mean, my experience with the benzos and nobody standing up and saying this is what's going on, I don't know if ethically they would even do that, if they would, you know, try and give you their opinion if they're involved with psychiatrists that are doing the ECT. I don't know.
That would seem to be an ethical conflict of interest if it would have to be an outside psychiatrist. And then you may have that right, but would your insurance pay for a second opinion?
Right.
And that's the question. Sometimes it's not. The devil is in the details.
And then I'm looking at the draft pamphlet, Loretta, that you and John and others are putting together, Dr. John Breeding. There's a section on financial disclosure, and so it reads. The cost of ECT varies significantly. Cost of the procedure itself may vary from $100 to $300 per treatment for the psychiatrist's bill. Hidden costs include fees for the anesthesiologist and the surgery suite, up to $800 combined per session, room and board at the hospital, usually $800 to $1,300 per day at a private psychiatric hospital, psychotherapy charges by the psychiatrist average $100 to $150 per hour, consultant fees, and charges for whatever drugs you will be administered. Depending on the setting and whether you are an inpatient or outpatient, there will be variable fees for the, quote, operating room and the hospital. You should obtain a full financial disclosure of all costs in writing prior to your decisions about any procedure. And I think that it's very important for people to understand. And also, Linda Andres, Doctors of Deception, really unfolded and uncovered so many of the financial incentives and the outright scam that is being taken upon people in doing this.
I really think if we could get into this thing and make them tell us up front what the cost is going to be, there would be a lot of changes in how they are billing us. I just was in the hospital for some pain in my abdomen. I have no clue what I am going to hear from them when I start getting the bills in. You sign now for the treatment or you don't get treated. And then you get billed. And it's the same with this procedure. You sign.
Wow.
And you don't know until you're billed what it's going to cost. It's the only contract that I know of that people are expected to sign blindly and then find out later what the cost is going to be. You would not sign for a home, a car, or anything else without knowing the cost. This medical system that we have is the only thing that they can make you sign a contract without knowing what it's going to cost you.
It really is. This is just so criminal. It's absolutely criminal. Deborah, were you trying to say something also?
No.
Oh, okay. Was it Yvonne, maybe?
Yeah. What was the third thing? Informed consent. You talked about the lack of disclosure on the money end, and you said what was the third tab on the site?
The securing records. I'd also like to give out the number if you'd like to call in and have a question or a comment that you'd like to give. Area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. You said you just added this securing records piece to the website, Deborah?
Yeah, that was yesterday. I was trying to, you know, when I filed my suit, I was sending lots of records to all these attorneys. I spent thousands and copies and mailings to all these attorneys. I went Oregon State, Washington State, and I did national trying to secure somebody. And what I was thinking about was if people are interested, that in securing these specific records will give an attorney an idea of your state of mind and your medical condition at time of consent. Because that's what, you know, where I think the end is for lawsuits. Is not
now
so
I'm
much.
I'm gonna ask a stupid question. How did they thwart you in getting your medical records? Now I know in most cases you have to pay per page for it. But
yeah.
I
was very willing to pay for it, but when I went in I would specifically ask for certain things and they would make multiple copies of the same page. They would put blank pages in. At
mm-hmm.
one point when I asked for consent paperwork, I was told that it was probably verbal. They couldn't find it. And I said, you know, it involved general anesthesia, so I hope it wasn't verbal. And they finally came up with the three consents. But, you know, they would stall. They wouldn't give me the things that I asked for. And it was very frustrating. And I didn't know what to do. So, you know, I just called around and they said, you know, contact the Office of Civil Rights and they'll start investigating.
I think it's important, especially if people are listening who don't have maybe access to the Internet, if we could just go through each of the following records that you – so if people want to try to get an attorney, you've put together a list of records that people should try to get from their medical
sure.
records to present. And so if you could just go from the following or the records you will need to request
sure.
and just talk about each one of them.
Okay. You need all ECT consent signed and associated records for your last admission. The thing is, for malpractice, the time frames vary state to state. The physician I sued in Washington was on a 3-year medical malpractice time limit. Oregon, where Kaiser was 2 years. You want to go from your last admission, and you don't want to think, oh, I can get an attorney. It's been 2 years since I discovered that I was wrong somehow. You have to start as soon as possible. If it's a 2-year state, then you want to try and get those records at least 6 to 8 months from your last ECT treatment. So the next thing is all anesthesia consent signed on last admission for ECT. I couldn't find one anesthesia consent that was signed by myself for ECT, which I just realized fairly recently, which could be a potential problem for them. You want nursing medication records for 24 hours
before. I'm sorry, can I just interrupt you for a second? Somebody's got the sound on their computer on, and it's coming over the background.
Yes.
So if you could lower your sound down. Sorry. Thanks. Okay, go ahead, Deborah.
Nursing medication records for 24 hours before every ECT treatment on last admission. With that, you're trying to prove that you're impaired if they're asking for anesthesia consent before every single ECT treatment. So you want to look at medication. Any emergency room records from last admission. You want a drug screen lab report, psychiatric admission and discharge summaries, history and physical, social worker assessment, any 72-hour mental health hold paperwork, nurse's notes for 24 hours prior to every ECT treatment, and physician progress notes for 24 hours prior to every ECT treatment.
Wow.
Those
so, okay. So I'm just thinking and like scrolling through my head of my own medical records, and I'm just like they don't have any of this. So that's probably why this is so difficult in process to get is because they probably don't really keep them. And I just want to mention again the dangers of electronic records, but also maybe mm-hmm. where this will serve some kind of convenience of them being mandated to keep these types of things. So that's records that you will need. And then what are some tips that you have for people in the process of getting their medical records? If you could just go through each of these and talk to them a little bit.
Sure. Because they are so hesitant, if they suspect litigation is pending, they're going to stall you. That's what I found. I mean, it took me, even with an attorney helping me get medical records, it took a good 3 to 4 months. To get these records, which shouldn't normally take more than 1 to 2 weeks at the most. But
I think by HIPAA
records,
it's supposed to be only, like, there's a time limit by HIPAA of what...
Right. It should be less than a month.
Yeah.
Right. So when you go to medical records, what I would suggest is keep a log of every interaction you have with the medical records department. Document who you talk with, any phone calls, letters you send. Make copies of all correspondence. Document date, time, what was requested, and note any problems. When you fill out the medical request form, write exactly what is on the above list. Do not have them mailed. Pick them up.
Okay, I just want to back you up a minute because this is so maybe like one of the things that people can do is like immediately buy a notebook or create a file in your computer and create a logbook of the ways that you're going to track all of the information that you're doing that you have it.
If you're post-ECT, you're still going to be having some memory issues, of course, and some cognitive issues. And so you need to write who you talked with down in this book. You know, if you talk to a lawyer, write his name down, what was discussed, because you won't recall a lot of it.
I also just want to say, like, for me, I don't know if other people may have these same kinds of hesitations, but when I first started making calls to people in power about either getting records or advocacy or whatever, I was at the very beginning of, for a very long time, actually, very intimidated to ask people on the phone what their name was or to ask them to spell their name if I didn't understand what they had said. Mm-hmm. And it really is very important to know that they have a job and they're there and people know that they're there and they're supposed to be answering the phone and that it's okay to ask them their name. Even now sometimes I get intimidated when I'm talking to somebody like, you know, somebody's office, like a governor's office or something, of asking the person on the phone who I'm talking to spell their name for me if I don't get it the first time around or something. And I think that when we keep these kinds of notes, it also adds to the evidence base. And so just having some tools, if this is the first time you're doing something like this, keep a notebook or a computer file, always the same file, save it multiple times.
If you call on Dropbox or something. I request, I think they're not just people that have ECT. I request information from my primary care doctor because I had a very good friend that she had found out in the records she had to have a hysterectomy. And if they had only told her, like, a few years earlier that she had fibroids, she would have probably been able to have some kind of fibroid. They would have been able to be removed. And she was very upset because when she got her medical records and looked, there were things that the doctor decided, made a judgment that it wasn't important to tell her. I have a copy of my about every 5 years, and this update from there so I can have that information just because of that experience. And I think a lot of people should go back and do it. And even with the case with the ECT, maybe if the people that gave the ECT might not have good records, but maybe if the person mentioned it to a primary care doctor and they put in the records that the person was disoriented or whatever, there might be something else to back it up. But I think we all should periodically get updates what they put in files about us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In my situation, could I just say that?
Oh yes, please.
I have no recourse at all because everything that my last shock treatment was in 2000. I didn't understand what I could even do. I didn't start even asking questions until after 2007, long beyond. Even 2008 when I was really beginning to search this out, that was even still 5 years beyond the last hospitalization. Mm-hmm. So I really had no recourse. That's another reason why I'm so involved, because those who are experiencing these situations don't think to take notes. They don't understand, you know, mostly are never prepared to know that they need this information. Mm-hmm. And when it's denied, they think, okay, then, you know, I don't have a right to it. They do have a right to the information. Mm-hmm.
You know, this should be part of the informed consent process. What to do if you feel, what records to keep in case electroshock winds up being like it always is, torture. Do you know what I mean?
Well, they're not going to do that because they think that you're going to sue. I mean,
no,
I think
but we can do it. They may not do it, but we can do it. That people should know this as they're going through that this is part of it, and maybe over time, if enough of us are doing it, maybe we can get them to do it. I want to get back to the list of tips that you have, Deborah. So, on top of keeping all interactions that you have with the medical records department people and documenting any phone calls or letters and the time mm-hmm. and the date and things that were requested and any mm-hmm. problems you had, you say that when you fill out the medical request, that in the form to get your medical records, you should write exactly what is on that list above of the records that you need to request that we just went over, the all consents, the anesthesia consents, any 72-hour holds, all of that information should be listed in the request for the medical records.
Right. And so when you get your copies, don't have them mailed. Pick them up in person if you're able to. You're near the hospital where the ECT was done. I had them get lost in the mail a couple of times. They just never showed up. I don't believe that. But next, ask for a copy of the actual form that you're filling out to request that. Ask for a copy of that because one of my request forms was altered by medical records at a later date. So keep a copy of that request form with you.
Wow.
When they ask on the consent form, in most situations, it says, why do you want these records, basically? It says legal, personal, whatever. Put personal. Don't put in there that it's for litigation because it will just create more problems for you. When you pick up your records, have a copy of the initial request list with you and make sure it's all there. If it's not, tell them that you'll wait while they get it. And document this in the log also.
Okay, one second. So wait, just hold on one second because I want to go over that again. So that when you're standing, I remember when I went to pick up my records, and I remember standing in the basement of South Beach Psychiatric Center on Staten Island, New York, and being looked at like I was absolutely insane, and it was the most intimidating thing in the world. And I picked them up, and I paid my bill, and I left. And I couldn't even sit to stand there. And it never even dawned on me that I should check. And then when I got home, there were all these pages that had black outlines all over them.
Yep.
You have to make an obsessed Lauren back and forth. You get pretty mean about it. You're like, I'm not leaving until I have my records. I'm going to call security. I was so worried going back to Kaiser. I took a friend with me because I was so afraid security was going to call.
Yes.
Because I was so ticked off with medical records. I'm just sure I was going to get hauled away.
It really, and for people to know that when we call ourselves survivors of psychiatry and these atrocities, it really is a survivorship, and it really is something that never leaves you, and that just even being in these places can return so many horrible things, and the environment and the way that you're treated and so on and so forth. That it really for me is an emotional struggle. Even if I have to go there for a meeting or anything like that, I get nauseous as I'm approaching the light, the 3 miles away.
even going to the psychiatric symposium in Portland, where all these people are supposed to be working for psychiatric patients, just being around other psychiatrists and psychologists, you know, it's just very anxiety producing.
It really is, and I want to bring in Sue. Is that you?
Yes, yes, it is.
Hi
Lauren.
Hi Sue.
Loretta, Deborah, and Yvonne.
Hi.
Hello, all.
Hello.
You.
Hello. Thanks.
Hello.
Thanks for calling in, Sue. We were just going over this
Thank
list
you.
of things that you should, some tips about picking up your records in person. And then Deborah, you and Sue, if you give us a minute, I know I'd love to have you talk a little bit about your experiences. I just want to get through the rest of this list, but I wanted to bring you in. So asking for a copy of the medical request form that you actually originally gave them, so that, because you said that yours was altered.
Mine was altered with letter request. The things were actually crossed out on a HIPAA form, and I said you can't legally cross things out that I've requested. So anyway, on the last one, if after several attempts or continued problems such as stalling to get what you want, if it's greater than 4 weeks, then you can contact the federal office in your state. It's called the Office of Civil Rights. They'll do a formal investigation if they find cause, and they investigate when patients can't get their medical records. They'll send you a complaint form, and when you return it, include copies of your log, initial request, and copies of all correspondence. You keep a copy, too, and this usually gets medical records going.
That's really interesting that they do formal investigations when someone can't obtain their medical records. So for anything you're going through with psychiatry, maybe a first step is to try to get your medical records. And then if you can't get them, then you have a direct in to the Office of Civil Rights. That's a great tip in general. For any psychiatric or medical practice, for that matter, probably.
And believe me, when I got my records, there were emails going back and forth that they gave me copies of, surprisingly, between medical records and psychiatry to their mental health unit. Should we release records? You know, what if we release records, what happens? So that was going back and forth. So you know that they're communicating with the psychiatrist. And my psychiatrist, the UCT doctor, actually called me and said, would you like to come in and we can go over records together? I told him no, and that I would review them myself. So, you know, if this is a physician that you're thinking about suing, you know, you may not want to go in and discuss your records with this physician and just, you know, have somebody review them with you that has a little bit of background.
So hold on a second. So, because it says don't be surprised to get a phone call from the physician who did your ECT on your private psychiatrist if different. And so because they've been alerted that you're trying to get your records, they may call.
Exactly. That's what I was saying. The emails were going back and forth.
Wow. So this is like even sometimes after years of maybe having some continuation, it's like, yeah, you think I'm ever coming near you again? Are you kidding?
That's fine with me.
Let me explain it to all to you.
I think Yvonne said, yeah, let me explain it all to you. this is just what a crime and what a fraud and human rights violation. It really is a crime against humanity. Sue, I just want to bring in Sue. Hang on for a second, because I just want to bring in Sue. And Sue, if you would talk about the international campaign to ban electroshock and some perspective that you have, and then Yvonne will get right to you.
Okay.
I'd like to talk about my story about electroshock, basically what happened to me. My website is intcamp.wordpress.com, and it's self-explanatory. It just goes through all the stuff, you know, about the effects of electroshock, the stats and that. So if you go there, it's all self-explanatory, but I think people need to hear my story again. I'll just make it brief, okay, Lauren?
Okay.
I'm going to surmise that. My name is Sue Clark Wittenberg, and I was born in Ottawa. I had parents that had abused me, and my uncle molested me. And at 17, I left my home, that was upper middle class home, I was homeless on the street, and then a friend took me in, and then I was homeless, and I went to high school. I missed a few months of high school, and the school shrink came in, psychologist came in, said, Suzanne, you missed a lot of time. What's going on? So I told her the whole story like I told you people. And she says, I have an appointment for you today to go down to the Royal Ottawa Hospital, ROH. I was 17. I was homeless. I didn't have a cent in my pocket. I had a bus ticket, and that was all. I went to emergency, and I saw a shrink and a nurse. I told them the whole story of me being beaten up and thrown down the stairs by my mom and threatened with my life and all that. So they said, okay, come on. Your nerves are bad. I said, okay. Well, I didn't have any options. I didn't know about social services because my dad had a big job. I didn't even know about social services. So I went in for a few days, they said, but that turned out to be 3 months. I was in a locked ward and given lots of medications. I was told to sign a paper. Said, what is this paper? Don't worry about it. Just sign it. Well, I think I was on a drug trial or something. So I went in and out for a year. I was in the ROH, went to my parents, and I got depressed from, because I was with my folks, and my folks were abusive, okay? So I'll get into the story. Just give me a chance. And then what happened, in March of the next year, I was there back at the Royal Ottawa. I tried to hang myself, and a nurse saved my life, and they sent me to a long-term care facility, the 60 miles away from Ottawa. Brockville Psychiatric Hospital, BPH. I was there for 6 months, March to September 73, and I have my birthday. I was going to turn April 9th, 18th, so I have my 18th birthday there in a terrible psychiatric hospital. They're all terrible, okay? So I saw Dr. Sipus. I was on Ward H, a current ward. And he said, Suzanne, come into my office. He said, I want to give you something new for your depression. I said, what? He said, I'm going to put I'm going to put electricity through your brain. I said, what the heck is that, putting electricity through my brain? Oh, don't worry, Suzanne. It's just going to help calm your nerves and make you better, and then you won't feel depressed anymore. I told him right away. I said, it's going to be like frying my brain like an egg. So they put me into the room. I was hollering and screaming, and I bit the staff, apparently. Okay, that peer told me years later. And on my fifth electroshock, my heart stopped. So I died and I came back because they revived me. I became an activist. In 1990, I fired the shrink and I quit psychiatry. I went off my pills cold turkey. Not very good, not a good thing to do. Then I became an activist and I formed four groups. I have a group in Ottawa called Psychiatric is called the Survivors of Ottawa, running now for 21 years with four staff who are psychiatric survivors. I founded that group, and then I had another group before, another group, and then, so I have four groups. Anyhow, what happened was, electroshock tried to kill me. So my husband and I, in the year 2005, founded the international campaign to ban electroshock. We know that the 1 in 200 people die from it, and you know all the rest, the memory, as given to, women who are postnatal, pregnant, the elderly woman. So that's
how
my
many,
story
how
in
many
a nutshell.
People die? How many people die?
1 in 200.
One out of every 200
people. Yes, that's the
one out
figure,
of every 200.
And that 100,000 people in the U.S. yearly get ECT, and it's 1 to 2 million people yearly worldwide, that get ECT. But that our aim at the ICBE. Okay, we're telling people worldwide what's going on, and I want to do some of the work, now with the politicians. I've been sick for about 2 or 3 years with diabetes and other stuff. I can't walk anymore, so I have a lot of physical disabilities, but my husband and I aim to go to politicians, knock on their door, and say, this has to stop, this torture. I call it psychiatric genocide. Okay, that's my story. Thanks for listening. I'm still on the line, baby.
1 out of 200.
It's been a long time to talk, but...
Thanks, Sue. Yeah, please stay on the line, because I think that you have a wealth of information that we need to bring in. Yvonne, you were saying 1 out of 200.
That's unacceptable. Even when people have operations, they talk about, 1 out of 30,000 or 3,000 have that. 1 out of 200, that's very unacceptable. That's very high. They try to promote, like I said, as being last resort. Even if you go on a site like WebMD, they say, well, only some people have it. I'm very glad that people are collecting this information because there's a great falsehood out there about it. And I wanted to ask somebody a question, maybe they can answer it, because when I go get medical records, I always find out how much the cost is, because I didn't know this, and I don't know if this is true or not. They just tell me that I had to pay 25 cents per sheet, and I don't know if they have to charge or if they don't have it written somewhere, the amount, can you get the records, or can they deny you your records because you can't afford to pay?
I don't know if they will deny because you can't pay. I know some of the hospitals that I got records from didn't charge. Kaiser, like I said, I had 3,000 pages of medical records, so it ended up costing quite a bit. I don't remember how much it cost me per page. I think it was like something like 10 cents a page or something like that after the first 25.
Uh-huh.
Some places are free.
Because I just think it's a good idea. No, I learned this from having a day in the Navy. People, if you know any people that are in the military, you'll see them with a folder, sometimes carrying kind of an abbreviated medical record around with them. I think it's a good idea just to every once in a while to get those records. They don't write down everything anymore like they used to. The reason why is because they're afraid of lawsuits. But I think this is a good idea because there's things that you don't know that could be in your medical records. And, you know, every 5 years, I try to go and find out what's happening there. My psychiatrist doesn't keep very much records anymore. But
no,
the primary...
Yeah, and I'm just looking on, I mean, I found Georgia's standards says shall not exceed 75 cents per page for the first 20 pages, which are copied, and 65 cents for pages 21 through 100, and 50 cents for each page copied in excess of 100 pages would be the maximum that may be affected by mailing charges. But as Deborah pointed out, you should go get them in person. But I kind of remember from HIPAA it being 10 cents, not more than 10 cents a page. But I'm having a little trouble finding that, but I'm going to continue to look for it.
Can I just say that the last time that I got records actually for myself, they were allowed, HIPAA was allowing them up to the first 25 pages, they were actually allowing for $1.25 per page. That is one-sided, just not double-sided copy. This to me was very disturbing. But also, this is only a guideline by HIPAA that they allow this charge. Any doctor, any hospital, by choice, can give you those records at no charge.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I think it's a good idea just every 5 years just to go and get some. They're not that very thick. Well, 3,000 pages was a lot for you.
Yeah, that was just one hospital. There were 8 other hospitals.
Yeah, that probably helped your settlement out of court, too, did it not?
It settled out of court, yes. Yeah,
yes.
Last November.
Because
and
you had...
my records, too. Okay, I went to the Royal Ottawa Hospital, okay, the first hospital that I went to. I was in and out for, okay, the 18 years. I went down to see the person that... in the records department, I said, I'm poor. So it was $250. I said, I'll pay half. And she said, okay. So I paid cash $125 for 1,000 pages.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so, but you may be able to get it legally, and if they're giving you trouble getting it, you can contact the Office of Civil Rights. And so this is really important for people to know that there are other things that you can do. And I think that the materials that Deborah has put together on ectjustice.com are really valuable, and that questionnaire is really interesting to see if you would be able to successfully collect enough information to get some kind of class action or some kind of litigation interest in lawyers. And
or
if you're
even,
a lawyer out there listening.
Even just one person. I mean, if one person wins, we all win on some level.
Right.
You know, just one person going forward trying to, you know, and later on down the road, if there's potential for class action, look at that.
Could I ask Debbie a question?
Yes,
Deborah. Sure. Okay. This pertains to a record that I have requested, actually, and I'm still waiting to receive, and I haven't yet to receive it. It was actually on, and it's in front of me here, on February 13, I requested some information, and when I received the packet, I realized the forms I had specifically requested were not included, and so I contacted them again. And to date, I still don't have that information. So
it's been longer than a month.
Yeah, it was February 13th, and then the letter that I sent them to let them know I had not gotten my information was the April 28th. It took them a while for me to even get what they did send. And then I sent them this letter on the 28th of April, and I have yet to receive what I requested.
Are you able to personally go down there?
It's quite a drive.
I would call them up and just tell them, you know, I'll report you to the Office of Civil Rights if I don't get this in the next 2 weeks.
And then follow through
with that.
Okay. I didn't know about civil rights, but I have contacted them several times, actually, by phone, and they informed me that they would be turning it over to actually the nurse that works with the doctor, and that they would be in charge of generating the form, the letter that I requested, if they do not have the documents that I requested. If those do not exist, I have asked for a letter stating that those documents do not exist.
Okay.
And I have yet to hear back from them. And I was just kind of biding my time here to see. I wanted them to have plenty of time to get this information.
Have plenty of time. I would just be very insistent and to know who you've talked to and the times that you've talked to them and call the Office of Civil Rights and let the medical records know that you're doing this and that, you know, you're going to follow through with that.
Okay. I can do that because I have the numbers, the names. I've been pretty good about documenting.
Good.
Appreciate your website here. It's very beneficial, you know.
Good. Thank you.
The Office of Civil Rights, is that federal or state Office of Civil Rights?
It's a federal office. For Oregon, for some reason, Oregon doesn't have one. I had to go through Seattle in Washington to file.
Mm-hmm.
So. And they'll give you a case number and, you know, just keep that someplace safe so you can refer to it. And they'll have a phone number where you can contact somebody while they're investigating.
The Office for Civil Rights can be found at www.hhs.gov/OCR/office/. And so that's the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services website, and it's the page for Office for Civil Rights. If you also just Google Office of Civil Rights Federal, it'll come up. And so there they will have lists of all the state offices and how to contact people locally where you are. And I think that this is a great, great, great resource, Deborah, and I want to thank you for calling it. To my attention, because I didn't know about it either. I didn't know that they got involved with medical record kinds of issues, and I think that that's a great foot in the door to have what is in the medical records revealed and then be able to take litigation strategies, or if in the case of, like, myself or Loretta or others who the time limits have expired, to really get involved in the work on the federal level and at certainly local and state levels, also in stopping the use of electroshock from the use of actual medical records. And I think that this is really important, what you're doing.
Thank you.
And so I want to just give out the number. It's area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. Area code 503, your line is open if you have something that you'd like to talk about. Okay, maybe not there. So if you're waiting on the line and would like to talk at any point, just make sure to press 1 so I know to patch you in. And if you need to, if you want to call, it's area code 267-521-0167. I want to point back for a second just to your web page, the page on electroshock and children on ectjustice.com, and remind people of John Breeding's work, and then Brenda LeFrancois, who was on last Wednesday night's electroshock show, also with Dr. Breeding, did put out an article also about the utmost discretion, how presumed prudence leaves children susceptible to electroshock, that was written with Cheryl Van Dylan Smith, Simon Adam, Peter Bragan, and Brenda LeFrancois. And so this, the issue of electroshock on children is something that we are working in the United States and all over the world to end. It is still legal to use on children, and is used on children, and at alarming rates that, and as has been mentioned before, that we don't even know because there's no mandate to report what its use is. So, Deborah, anybody, I'm just wondering if you would talk a minute about the electroshock in children and what kind of issues that presents.
Delusion.
Hi, are you there? I was just wondering if anybody wanted to talk about the issue of electroshock on children.
I don't know much about that. I just know that I think it's a travesty. It's brutal, and to put children through that is just it should be unmentionable, unthinkable.
It really is horrifying to see what kind of I don't even know how somebody could think that this is a good idea to use electroshock on children, and that it's something that we really need to stop and mm-hmm. have attention call to for it. And you know, there's it's not gone away. A new book just came out actually promoting the use of electroshock on children in 2013, and it really is. The name of it is, hang on, I have it buried on my shelf somewhere. I don't know. It's an edited volume that has multiple authors, and of course my eyes aren't matching my bookshelf fast enough. So there it is. It's on my desk, buried under papers. Sorry. It's called Electroconvulsive Therapy in Children and Adolescents, and it was edited by Neera Gazunin and Gary Walter, and it was published by Oxford. Audacity. Oxford University Press.
Oh, okay.
And it was published in 2013. And it includes chapters by Edward Shorter on the history of pediatric ECT, which I really feel he missed the mark on in a lot of places. The mechanism of action of ECT by Max Finck. And Max Finck is who Kathy, who called the other night, had brought up about the video that she was watched as part of the quote-unquote informed consent process, where they only show the woman's like little pinky toe moving, and what a fraud the video is, and how it doesn't really discuss issues of memory loss, and she talked about her own devastating experiences with then not being able to remember her boyfriend after the torture was committed upon her, and so I feel like so Max Finck is now being hailed by Oxford University. And being given the ability to write a chapter about it. And then a whole bunch of other people. It's 200, 300 pages long.
Well, some of the deception with psychiatry, I'd like to add this, is the idea of therapy. We have grown up with the idea of therapy as being something that promotes healing. And electroshock electroconvulsive therapy. I want to stick with the term that FDA uses. It's electroconvulsive therapy. And therapy has nothing to do with promoting healing in this situation, but the electroconvulsive part of it has everything to do with encouraging brain damage and disability and people going on to disability, and then the taxpayers are responsible.
Right. And it, and it's not therapy, and it's not treatment, and I appreciate you pointing that out, and that it's important for people to understand that this is torture and this is a crime against humanity. And while they call it electroconvulsive therapy, therapy is the last thing that this is, and treatment is the last thing that this is. And, you know, since 1938, when it, electric shock was first used, this there has just been pushback against it, and the industry continues to win. There are a couple of people who are online on the line. If you'd like to join in the conversation, please press 1 on your phone so I know to patch you in. And if you'd like to call and have a question, the number is area code 267-521-0167. That's area code 267-521-0167. And first-time callers are more than welcome. So, Deborah, I think on the info and resources page, you also have quite a bit of information that people can get other information about. And would you be willing to talk a little bit about why you chose these things and anything, any highlights that you'd like to mention from them? Deborah, are you there?
You might have gotten off to listen.
Oh, let me see. Deborah, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay, because we had lost you for a minute. I'm sorry. I don't know if you heard, but I was just asking. I'm still getting used to the technology of this. Sorry, folks. Mm-hmm. I was just asking if you would be willing to talk a little bit about the information about the resources that you put on the ectjustice.com webpage. And mm-hmm. any highlights from them or particular reasons why you think people might be interested in going to these things?
Well, I think the sites that I picked for ECT Justice are just sites that I feel that tell the truth about what happens, and that is pro-patient as far as providing the correct information. There's just agencies that would come up.
I think again, just to remind people about the questionnaire, if they feel like they want to contribute information to this, and, that it's another place where people can organize, to add to the literature base on this, and I think that that's really great. I'm just wondering if any of you who are on the line have any questions or want to say anything.
Yes, I do. Okay, I've often talked to Dodd, and he says there is no such thing, as a voluntary consent, because right before they shock someone, they say, don't worry about this electroshock. It's not going to cause much damage. It's just going to give a little bit of memory loss. That's a lie. So people are consenting to a lie. The doctors do not tell them the truth of what electroshock really does, and they never tell the person it always causes brain damage, because I'll tell you, there's lots of tests and studies to prove now that electroshock always causes brain damage. See the site by Dr. Bregan, bregan.com, BREGGIN.com. So there is no such thing as true consent, because the doctors are lying to the patients before they get it.
I agree.
I just want to make that point. And Don White knows his stuff.
Yes, he certainly does, and I agree also.
He's my mentor, and he set me straight years ago. I asked him about that, and he always talks about it in his, when he writes and that. But like with me, I was a kid, 17 years old, because in Canada, that an adult is 18. My father signed for them to fry my brain. My father signed the papers. And another thing, years ago for my first website, I had my name and my phone number, and I talked about electroshock, and I talked about Dr. Louis Sipos, S-I-P-O-S, gave me electroshock in Brockville. I got an email from his son. How dare you put my father's name on your website? He said, I will sue you. And I saw that he had some type of name, Sipos, of course, and Shell. Okay, the company Shell, like a bigwig. So I wrote back, sue me, make my day, and I'll tell the truth about your father and BPH, and also that I died on my fifth electroshock, and I came back. I said, sue me, make my day, and I had that term, make my day, way before, okay, you know, that actor said that there in a movie, Clint. I said it years before he did in a movie, and I never heard from his son again, from Dr. Sipos's son. I said, sue me right away. I can't wait to go to court. He never sent me another email.
That's wonderful and horrible all at the same time, and these are the real infringements on our human rights and civil and constitutional rights, and just the idea that I don't know, as somebody who's trained in medicine and myself, but I mean for a doctor who's trained in medicine, to think that this is a good idea on any level. It's just, and it goes back to the discrimination that we face, and the fact that they can treat us in this way, and that they can build on these frauds in the way that they do, over and over again, all over the world, that this is going on. 1 to 2 million people, Sue, you said?
It's 1 to 2 million people yearly get electroshock.
And one
and that,
out of
okay, the 70, it's, and that, okay, the elderly women are given more shock than anyone else. 70% of electroshock is given to women over 60 years old. And another thing I want to say, last week, okay, that we had our first show, I mean, of course, it's your show, on electroshock, and Brenda LeFrancois said that when they give children electroshock, their brains are being formed, okay, at 2 and 3 and 4, so they don't know how much damage is happening to a child's brain because the skull is being developed as well as the brain. I think you mentioned, think maybe, Lauren, that you may have recalled what she said about this, Brenda said about the child's brain being developed.
Yes, I mean, what they do to children is just horrifying, and the amount of children that are being subjected to this, and that they don't I'm sorry, I'm just looking at the wrong note, and so I thought I had it and I didn't. But I mean, Brenda LeFrancois in the article that I mentioned before on children and electroshock that her and others, including Peter Bragan, put out, the utmost discretion really is important for people to read and to look through, because, you know, a young person's brain, same as with the drugs, we don't know what's happening to these young people by implanting these chemicals and shooting electricity through a child's brain. And, you know, and this all goes back to Dr. Loretta Bender, who was electroshocking children at Bellevue in the 40s. Over 600 children that we know of that she put into her quote-unquote research subjects, where people were replicating what she was doing, where she identified that back then it was used for quote-unquote schizophrenia, and she defined childhood autism and schizophrenia, and either these childs can be either, quote, puny or quote retarded or quote unconcretistic in their thinking, or can be exceptionally brilliant, have an extraordinary vocabulary, cause counter transference in adults. And that the treatment for either of these children, the quote-unquote treatment, the torture that they were subjected to, was being electroshocked and drugged. And prior to her using electroshock, she was also doing testing on insulin and metrazole on these children, and then comparing the insulin and metrazole shock to the electric shock. And it hasn't ended. And now they've just extended the group of people that they are using this on. And the idea of all of these women over 60 years old who are being electroshocked, probably often without family around to look after them, you know, probably in, you know, quote-unquote adult homes or in state hospitals for their entire lives. And we're killing them. We're absolutely killing them. When you look at the data from New York State of the difference between over 75 and 55 to 65, or however they have it, 45 to 65, it's like it goes down to the single digits, 1%, 2%. Well, there was 40% 10 years ago. So where did those 40? Because they're killing us, and this is murder, and they're maiming. They're maiming us. Somebody last night was talking. Jason was talking about the way that it's just maiming people, and certainly Andrew Spell said that they maimed and murdered us. And this is just, we need to call public attention to this. I'm just wondering if anybody has any final thoughts. We have about 15 minutes left.
Electroshock has been given for 70 years now. How many people have died by psychiatry from the psychiatric drugs, the electroshock, the beatings? I call this psychiatric genocide because in the Human Rights Declaration, it says not to harm a big group of people, psychiatric survivors. So I don't take this lightly. I don't call this murder. I call it psychiatric genocide, and I sent it to Don Weitz by email, and he said, yes, it is. It is psychiatric genocide because they have a doctor's name. They don't get prosecuted or charged with assault.
That's, you know, you're right.
Don Weitz agreed with
it. It is. It's psychiatric genocide. You're right. You're right.
Because he said it harms a whole group of people. If you, me and Lauren, and all of us went out for years torturing people, I'm not saying Lauren, I say, you know, like anybody, okay? Joe, Sandra, Mary, thousands upon thousands, you know, okay, they tortured your brain, they gave you pills to kill you. That's genocide. But no, the doctors have this doctor's name. It's called therapy. You know what I say to that? I can't say it online, but it's called BS, okay?
Yeah,
you say the word, Lauren.
Yeah.
You say the word.
But, you know, you can go back to the 1930s, and when German doctors, with the, you know, this is where you take a whole class of people, and you disregard their health, that you lie. You know, they did twin studies there. They did all kinds of things, and this is the same thing. And to even think that a child would have the capacity to give consent. And you know these parents, you know, a child, supposedly by the time they're 5 years old, they have, you know, most of their memory. We talk about adults losing their creativity and stuff. Just about this, some of these procedures, not just the ECT, but the chemical, some of these things just should not be allowed to be, your parents shouldn't be allowed to give consent.
Right, and I just want to add in here, especially in the 1940s, and it would be really interesting if we were able to get the data now, that there were actual agreements between, like, the New York Foundling Hospital that was a foster care, and the city, Bellevue Hospital, which was part of NYU and is part of NYU, in order to use kids who were in foster care. So there was a pipeline from foster care into electroshock and into psychiatry in general. And that definitely still is evidenced by the drugging of young people who were in foster care who are already trauma survivors. But the certainly the eugenics movement of the mental hygiene, quote-unquote mental hygiene movement, which was a cover for the eugenics movement, except when they were outright, you know, saying that sterilization of mental patients was a good idea, is definitely inherent in this. And so, Sue, your psychiatric genocide term, I believe, goes right in line with it. And because then the other thing of being able to remove the children of people and place them with other groups of children, and that certainly happens to people with psychiatric histories at an alarming rate for no reason other than the fact that they have a psychiatric assignment. And so these are really, really big, important things to conceptualize the entire idea around. And then I think, Deborah, you really brought in some concrete strategies and great tips about ways that people can try to create their own litigation strategies and to try to find lawyers. And I think that ectjustice.com offers a great resource for people, and I hope people go check it out and look at the and look at the questionnaire and consider responding to it.
If anybody wants to pursue a potential case, they can always call me, and I'd be glad to help them.
Do you have a number where you can be reached?
If they just go to the website, the ECT Justice website, and go to Action, at the bottom there's an email site that they can go to if they have any questions.
Okay, let me see. Action. Where is Action? At ectjustice.com.
Right.
And the phone number. Okay, great. Super. And so I think that this is really very important. And I'm just wondering if you have any final thoughts that you'd like to tell listeners or anything you'd like to share or ask or talk about with any of the other people online.
Yes. I think one thing that hasn't been addressed yet is when you're talking about deaths related to ECT from the procedure itself, you also have to look at the people that are committing suicide after having ECT because they can't cope with the after effects, their relationships with their families, their memories being lost, and leading to suicide. Because I've talked to people that have actually committed suicide following ECT, and it's very real out there.
That's a really important point, and that it's not just the procedure that happens, but it's the entire that's part of the torture, but it's the entire aftermath of it, and having to live with not remembering certain aspects of your life and your experiences, and any physical damage that bodily injury that you've incurred because of it also. And things like Kathy was talking the other night about slipped discs and, or herniated discs. And so the way the physical ramifications and the emotional and cognitive impairments, having to not be able to practice your field, not being able to be a nurse any longer, how that must have affected you.
Little or no recourse if things go wrong, because even though they lie, this is we say that in psychiatry a lot of things happen they don't allow to happen, they don't happen elsewhere. So they tell you that there's nothing going to happen. Believe them. You go in and get it, and then don't have your career. You don't have memories of the person that you're sleeping with that's supposed to be your husband, but you don't know who he is. Unless you go and take these precautions, and we don't want people to, if they had informed consent, they wouldn't have ECT. Mm-hmm. But you have little recourse unless you want to go to war or war with them. So, it's almost like this is a criminal enterprise.
It is a criminal enterprise. And then Jim Gottstein actually was talking about that. And PsychRights.org actually has a phenomenal amount of information about electroshock also and different litigation strategies that you can take, and is another great resource, as is endofshock.com, where you can download for free Leonard Roy Frank's electroshock quotationary. Linda Andre's Doctors of Deception is an absolute essential read. And soon, with the work of Loretta and Dr. John Breeding and others, there will be a new informed consent pamphlet coming out from that really provides the truth about what is going on. And Deborah's electroshock, ectjustice.com website, please go check that out and get involved. I just want to say, and Deborah, I think your point about suicide is always an important one to understand and to validate, and that there's so much hope out there for people. If you are listening to this and you are struggling, there are so many different ways to get involved. You can check out mindfreedom.org, and that's Mind Freedom International, and get involved, become a member. There's a network of over 10,000 people who are working toward changing the psychiatric systems. Their annual conference is going to be July 24th through the 27th in Connecticut at Wisdom House. And the keynote speakers include Robert Whitaker, who wrote Anatomy of an Epidemic and Mad in America, and is the influence behind the Mad in America website, and Mary Ellen Copeland, who's done the Wellness Recovery Action Plans, and has special booklets for different for people coming from different perspectives, including one on veterans. And if you're a veteran who's being subjected to this and want to talk about it, please call me. But the Mind Freedom Conference plans on, is going to be a phenomenal Creative Revolution 2014, and that's going to be a great event. And then July 13th through July 16th, we will, with the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance, we'll be hosting the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day vigil, and that will be held on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health in Albany, New York. And we sit vigil for 72 hours because 72 hours is how long they can detain, assess, and treat anybody, regardless of your whether you had a psychiatric history or not, and determine whether or not you need to be institutionalized. And so that'll be July 13th through the 16th in Albany, New York. In front, on the sidewalk, in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health. And then on June 19th, we will be having a vigil for Esmond Green, who was murdered by neglect at Kings County Hospital Center Psychiatric Emergency Room. And that will be June 19th from 4 to 6 p.m. On the sidewalk in front of Kings County Hospital. It's 410 Winthrop Street in Brooklyn, New York, and in front of Building R at Kings County Hospital Psychiatric Emergency. And so I hope you will join us there, and if you can't, there are event pages for all of this. There's a ton of ways to get involved. I think that the women who are online tonight, I thank you all for participating and for sharing your stories and your strength and your hope and your survival, and for the work that you do every single day to try to inform the public about the disastrous crimes against humanity that people are being subjected to and lied to about and not given full information. And I think that your work is just so, so important. And to anybody who's listening, if you have an idea for a show, would like to be a guest on the show and tell people about any advocacy or activism you're doing, or your organization or your work or your life story. Or if you have a news tip that you think something should be investigated, a human rights violation or a death that has occurred that you think has not been investigated properly, you can call the Talk with Tenny tip line at area code 718-273-8708. That's area code 718-273-8708. On June 24th, Dr. Bonnie Burstow will be on sharing her phenomenal amount of work, and we will be talking about, again, about electroshock and other atrocities committed by the psychiatric industry. And I will be posting more information about that shortly. And I look forward to many, many more conversations with people over the coming time. I want to thank you all again for talking out and speaking out, and I'm going to ask you to keep on talking. And until next time, talk to you soon.
Thank you, Lauren.
Bye, Lauren.
You
thank
did a fantastic job.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, Lauren.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.